Eddie Palmieri.
How about that?
Randy Brecker. That's right.
And the Latin side of Herbie Hancock. Conrad Herwig has made a franchise out of this. I think he started with Coltrane. You got Wayne Shorter. You got Herbie Hancock. You got Joe Henderson even in there, too. And here, the Latin side of Herbie Hancock. Well, he's got a Latin side, I'm sure. He's got a rhythm and blues side. He's got a dance side. He's got a classical side. He's got a movie side. He's got a Broadway stage side. He's worked in all those arenas. Different size arenas.
Yeah.
Right?
You talking about Conrad?
Yeah. And I'm talking about you.
Oh. Oh, that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
That's an introduction.
I was talking about Conrad, actually.
To my guest. Guest. You're not a guest. Did you see that photo of you and me outside?
I didn't. I'll look for it on the way out, though.
Yeah, well, if you miss it, there's another one just like it in the post office.
Okay, yeah, you ain't lying.
The two of us.
FBI.
Branford Marsalis is in town, and we are lucky enough to have his first record in 7 years that comes out March the 1st. And he's appearing tomorrow night, coming through with his quartet, the Jazz Standard in New York City. The recording entitled The Secret. Between the shadow and the soul.
Can you say that again?
The secret.
Yeah, man, that's beautiful.
Between the shadow and the soul.
Wow, yeah.
Now, see, if you know Branford Marsalis and his work, you know he knows his way into the crease.
Oh, my God.
Right? But the crease becomes a crevasse.
Yes.
Once you explore it, doesn't it?
Once you leave the hockey arena, it becomes a crevasse.
And you've had a chance. I'm not going to ask you, you know, why'd you wait 7 years? Because I know the answer to this. You once told me. Writing and playing and practicing is like being in game number 7 of the NBA playoffs. And at halftime, you go in and lift weights.
No, that's a misleading, whatever that, the press release that my people put out.
Uh-huh.
Because in between the 7 years, there's a record I did with Kurt Elling.
Correct. And you toured the world.
And
too.
We toured the world twice with Kurt. And so it wasn't just, hey, guys. Let's just take 7 years off and do nothing and then see how that makes the music sound. We were doing other things.
And on tour and working with Kurt Elling, what kind of an experience was that for the quartet?
Well, I think it was great for everybody. I think with the guys in the group, it had been a long time. Because Joey, they all played in dance bands as kids, you know. But they'd been a long time since they had to tone it down, as it were, play with a certain kind of discipline. All the solos had to be shorter. The emotions of the song had to be geared toward what was Kurt was singing. And I think that with Joey and Eric, they were a little like, oh, it feels so constrained. I said, give it time. It'll work. And then once you get used to playing in the box, then the box becomes wider.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, see, one, and then right in the middle of the tour, the box started to get wide and still stay in the box, which is, that's the magic to me.
Yeah.
It's not playing whatever you want whenever you want to. It's more about playing what the song requires and pushing at the edges, which is kind of what we do, especially now, like on this record is more a reflection of that.
It's what you do instrumentally too. Yeah. Absolutely. You don't need to be constrained by a lyric in order to,
right.
to push out.
Right.
Harold Mayburn, great example. 50
go.
Years ago, first record, A Few Miles from Memphis.
There you go.
Just a few weeks ago, just a few miles from here, it's Smoke.
That's right. Mabe.
Captured his record 50 years later, and the first track was the first track on that very first record.
No kidding. That's
so
great.
That's the deal, man. And you know, you look back
mm-hmm.
to look forward, and I don't hear that a lot.
Yeah.
But on your record, that comes out March the 1st, you looked back. Way back, of course, to bring your traction to where it is today, but a little bit back to pick up a piece by, say, Andrew Hill.
Mm.
What was it that attracted you to that piece?
Well, it sounded good. I mean, Revis brought it in. We played it. I said, yeah, this is good. Let's do it.
Let's do it, folks. The Snake Hip Waltz. As my friend Dorthon Kirk says, now that's modern jazz. With a look back to Andrew Hill, but I feel a look back even further than that because that gives you the wings to fly forward. Branford Marsalis and the quartet. Justin Faulkner, the baby of the group. He's only been there 10 years. Eric Revis on the bass. Joey Calarazzo on piano. Now, when you get that kind of synergy going, where you're a working band for that long, one breathes in, the other breathes out. Plus, these are four guys that aren't afraid to look at each other and talk and communicate. And for you, you grew up in a household, Branford, like that. You were one of the groovy guys at birth. Listening to your dad and his groovy guys.
The groovy boys. Oh, my God. You brought that up? That's good. He would laugh at that. He would laugh. Yeah, the groovy boys.
How's dad doing, man?
Old man's good.
Yeah.
Old man's good. He plays every Friday night at Snug Harbor in New Orleans. And
God bless him. The groovy boys had this thing, and it was not a silo approach to music. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. And I'll bring up something else. The creators.
Oh, my goodness.
Where you would morph, right?
That wasn't a morph. That was what I did back then.
Yeah.
I was an R&B guy. I was a funketeer. So the creators were just, it was a band, a dance band.
Yeah.
This is pre-DJs. So the DJs didn't start to come on the scene until 79, 80. But prior to that, there were nightclubs in New Orleans and high school dances in a lot of high schools, and they would hire these bands. And there were about 10 bands in New Orleans, and we would all fight to get these gigs.
He's being modest now, because people would come to see the creators. Why? Because within their creative process came the morphing of different tunes together.
Yeah, we did that.
It was kind of like a jam band kind of thing.
We had
right? Interesting
segues that other bands didn't have. But it was kind of this thing that it's not something at 16 that I would have articulated. But what was really cool about it is that we had the best of both worlds, because we had normal people who liked us, and then the musicians came to check out all of the nerdy segue stuff that we were doing that the audience did not care about at all. They just wanted to groove. So I learned at an early age that, if you really have this kind of nerd brain stuff, as long as it's grooving, it is all acceptable. But if it comes at the expense of the bottom, then no one's going to be interested.
Key word there that Branford just said, learning. You never stop that, do you?
No, why? Why would I want to?
Yeah, you never stop.
I haven't seen any asset to declaring oneself finished.
I saw you down the street here when the record Eternal came out.
Mm.
And you guys came out on stage and immediately jumped into The Impaler.
Yeah, it was.
And then at the end of that tune, you walked up to the microphone. You said, I'm sorry, that was for us. And then proceeded with an evening of some of the most gorgeous music I think I've ever heard. And when I ran into you a few weeks later in New York and told you what I thought of that concert, you said to me, I'm going to go home and gloat, because that only took me 20 years to learn. It is quite a long process, isn't it?
It is. It is. If you have to decide. I talk to my students about that all the time. I talk to my kids about it. if the fear of failure becomes so great that you fail to fail, then you fail to succeed. You have to be okay with failure, and you can't practice your way through. Like some of the mindsets was, I'm going to sit in the shed, and then when I perfect this song, then I'll play it. It's like, well, I'm just going to go out there and play it and screw it up. And it might take 6 weeks, it might take 2 months, but eventually I'll get to it and I'll be able to play it, and it won't sound rehearsed.
Uncomfortability breeds progress if you're patient.
Yeah, if you're patient.
You know, I mean, take for you, when you entered the world of classical music.
Oh, my goodness.
We're talking 7-8 years before.
That was
it's
painful.
Like, now it doesn't hurt
that
as
was,
much.
That was painful. Hurt wasn't the word I used, but yeah. that's it, yeah. It was about 8 years in. I'm like, wow, this doesn't hurt. This doesn't sound like garbage anymore. Yeah.
I tell you, it's not going to hurt tomorrow night. One night at Jazz Standard in New York City, there's two sets. Justin Faulkner, Eric Rivas, Joey Calderazzo, and Branford Marsalis. 4MFs playing tunes, man. That's what it's about. And they're going to have a great time. They're going to look back. They're going to push forward. And it's going to be some of the most exciting and, if I might say, gorgeous music you will ever hear. Filtering from the water flowers, from the upcoming recording, The Secret Between the Shadow and the Soul, the Branford Marsalis Quartet, tomorrow night, one night only, at the Jazz Standard in New York City. Why 7 years or 5 years or whatever for the first acoustic studio recording? And it's like, well, how long is this tour? How about 20 years, man? How's that working for you?
I love, man, those kind of questions crack me up. It just, and I get it, because if a person, even if they're a music writer, all the questions that they ask are going to generally be within the realm of what it is that they listen to on a regular basis and what they like. And the answer is almost always popular music. So all the questions you get are pop. So they'll ask a question like, you know, so how long is this Secret Between the Shadow and the Soul tour? I said, oh, it's been 40 years and it's still going on. So how many cities are you guys going to play? I said, yeah, that's not what we do. We just play.
And then we'll follow Pink Floyd into the room, and you know, they'll do The Wall, yeah. And we'll do The Secret.
The Wall. You got to go earlier than The Wall, dude.
Yeah.
Us and Them.
Oh, there you go.
Money.
Yeah.
Come on. Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
The Wall.
Umaguma.
That's right. More Roger Waters than, oh, you get, man, don't nerd me. Don't get me nerding out on the radio, man. Stop. So anyway, the point is all of those, you know, that whole line of questioning. It's like, no, we tour for a living. We're troubadours. That's what we do. We don't put out a record and then tour the record, and then when the record's done, sit around for 2 years hanging out on the beach in Ibiza. You know, we go back to work.
For you, home is Durham,
yes.
North Carolina.
Yes.
But does it feel like home because you're on the road so damn much?
Well, yeah. But when I get there, yeah, it feels like home.
Yeah.
You know, kids are there, wife's there, house there, you know, just... home.
So Reese is living there now?
No, Reese is in New York.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Please pass along a hello.
I shall.
When you see him.
I shall.
Yeah. So by doing this, by being a touring musician, it's, here we go, folks, I'm sorry, but we're looking over our shoulder because this is how those great records that you have in your collection, that's how they got to be like that.
Come on, man.
Right? They went out, worked.
Yeah.
They worked, man, like railroad worked those tunes.
I always grab, there's a whole decade and a half of records where they weren't touring music. They were musicians who knew each other. Like almost the whole Blue Note catalog is like jam session records. And when I started listening to jazz, I wasn't really fond of those records, which caused much consternation amongst me and my colleagues, you know, not for real, but like, are you kidding, man? That stuff's great. And I said, man, I'm not with it. And then as I got older, I realized why. I immediately, and it's probably because I joined a band when I was 12 years old, I gravitated towards bands. I didn't gravitate towards, you know, like singular great records. And so guys would say, man, Giant Steps is great. I'm like, yeah, that's cool, but the Coltrane record on Impulse is really great. And Love Supreme is great. And the record with Johnny Hartman is great. Man, what do you have against John Steph? Nothing. It's just the sound of the group. There's not a sound to the group on
and,
that record.
And go away for a weekend.
You got one genius and you got a bunch of people hanging on for survival.
Yeah.
You know?
Go away for the weekend and listen to Crescent.
Crescent. Oh, my God.
Good Lord. But that's how people make discoveries. And much of that work is on your own, isn't it? Because there's a misnomer, I truly believe, that some of the so-called contemporary instrumental musicians of today, because every once in a while someone has called that jazz, is going to lead people to Crescent, is going to lead people to Pharoah Sanders.
They've been saying that since I was a kid.
I don't think so.
I mean, it's something that here's the reality for me. When I got to the Berklee College of Music in 1979, Marvin Smitty Smith was my roommate. And he put on this Miles Davis record, Nefertiti. That is the first time that I ever heard Nefertiti. And I was 19 years old, and I was in a music school, trying to play jazz. And I looked at the cover, which is something that CDs have robbed younger people of the joy of just holding a cover and reading it. And Wayne Shorter was on the record, and I said, man, there's a guy named Wayne Shorter who plays with Weather Report. And he goes, that's the same guy, man. I said, no, it can't be. And Herbie Hancock, is that guy from Headhunters? Now, I'm studying to play jazz. And I did not know that Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter played with Miles Davis, and I had every Headhunters record and every Weather Report record. So the idea that people who don't study jazz or aren't totally into it are going to somehow jump a shark, It's not going to happen.
Well, so much of the way we live is the silo mentality to begin with, that for them to even jump, man, they ain't got the tennis shoes to jump out of the silo to go over here.
Well, you have to have a certain kind of curiosity.
Yeah.
Just to want to, if you like somebody enough, then you start going back, and then you can stumble into it. But that's a small group of people. People tend to like the thing that's current now, and then the next thing that's current. And I'm not saying it pejoratively. It's just what it is. It's like saying tall people are tall to me. I'm not opposed to tall people or shorter people. It's just, they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
And I'm mindful of that. So I don't hold on to some paradigm like one day we're gonna make a record and we're gonna win the lottery and all the kids are gonna buy it. When the word with interviews that I've done with people under the age of 30 and the word jazz comes up, whatever jazz it is they like is the kind of jazz where it's an instrumental version of the kind of music they are predisposed to liking in the first place.
Oh.
And I get that.
Yeah.
So, you know, they say, what do you think about this guy? I say, well, it's fine stuff. It's not really jazz. Whoa, wait a second. You know, this is the kind of jazz that should be. I say, well,
for them, it's comfort food, isn't it?
Familiarity.
They can get fuzzy with it.
Well, to use my dad's quote, when my dad was talking to a student about this very same issue in 1977, so nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
The student says, "You're wasting your time, Ellis. I know what I like." And my father says, "No, son. To know what you like, you'd have to know all the music in the world. What we see here is that you like what you know, and you don't know much." And I was like, "That's cool." You know, I was going to another school, Winton and I, and we would finish at 3:34. Dad wouldn't leave till 6, so we would just walk 6 blocks to the school where he was teaching and hang out. And I was like, "Wow, you like what you know."
See, and you apply that to anything, man.
Yeah.
You apply that to public opinion.
Yeah.
You apply that to the state of the state.
Of course.
You apply that to all these things.
You like what you know.
Yeah.
It's comforting. It's familiar.
Yeah.
And when you're put in a situation where you have to start thinking outside of the thing you know, I mean, that's why ultimately people talking about religion or politics turn so deadly, because people aren't talking about what they've learned or what they know. They're talking about what they've been taught and how they feel. And you can't go mess around with people's feelings.
Yeah, true.
You know, and this is like one of those old things, like the Democrat, Republican. It's like you have a person who believes in a certain thing, and then the opposition starts bringing them like concrete metadata, which is about to get you punched in the face. Because you can't challenge how somebody feels with what you know and they don't. It's not going to work in music. It's not going to work in anything. So I'm mindful of that when these conversations start. And I don't start getting into a jazz is a compendium of sounds that started from such and such. It's like, man, you like what you like. It's cool.
Right.
It just doesn't have a jazz vocabulary.
And when you have the luxury.
You know, if it makes you feel good to say it's jazz, I'm cool with that too.
Yeah.
You can call it jazz, but you can't get me to call it jazz.
Branford Marsalis tomorrow night, Jazz Standard, New York City, March the 1st. The album on OK Records, The Secret Between the Shadow and the Soul.
I think I'm going to start saying it like that.
That sounds like a radio. Remember those old radio?